Bonjour!
Comme ça, I'm Tink Laraval.
And I'm Dr. Catherine Wu, and you're listening to the Cultural Quotient Podcast.
In Season 1, we introduce the world to cultural intelligence, where it comes from and how it can help you with your cross-cultural relationships.
Now we are back for Season 2, where we share more stories and show you how CQ shows up in real life.
If you like what you hear, give us 5 stars or leave us a comment, question or feedback. We'll be happy to hear from you.
And now, enjoy the show!
Welcome to our last episode of Season 2.
Our last episode already.
I know. Time flew by so fast and we're nearing the end of 2023. But today we have a very exciting topic.
Yes.
Which is going to be about your recent trip to Cambodia.
Yes.
I saw some of your posts, right, on why you went there and who you met.
Yes.
But maybe set it up for us a little bit. Like, was this your first time in Cambodia?
Yes, it was. So I've never been to Cambodia and I was very excited to have that opportunity to go. So I went together with my university. We have this project that we run every summer. It's a collaboration between 5 universities in Europe, in Asia and in Australia. And every summer we bring 30 students from each institution together into one place. And for 2 weeks, they work together on an entrepreneurship project related to the UN developmental goals. And the idea is for them to explore some of these goals in the context of the country that we are in. Mm. So a few years ago, we went to China. We were in Singapore. During COVID, we did it online. And this summer in July, we went to Cambodia for the first time.
Nice. Which part of Cambodia were you?
We were in Phnom Penh.
Ah,
yes.
So tell me about what the activities that you were involved in, and I'm sure a lot of anecdotes on around culture.
Yeah, so this is a very interesting program. The idea is to bring students from all around the world to work in an international, intercultural environment. And students come to learn about entrepreneurship. But in reality, the skill that they develop is really cross-cultural collaboration. We have 5 institutions, so we form groups of 5, 1 student from each institution. For students, it's usually the first time ever in their life that they work in such an international environment. East and West cultures, we have students from the UK, from Netherlands, from Australia, from Singapore, from Cambodia, but we also have students from all over the world because most of these universities have students who come from everywhere. The program is designed like an entrepreneurship bootcamp when students work on developing an idea. So they have to do market research. They have to go and interview people. They really have to get to know very quickly the cultural, economical, political landscape of the country. And they have 2.5 weeks to create a prototype and a solution to a problem. So it's very intense. It's intense in the learning because they have very short deliverable, and it's also very intense in the team experience. So my role in that project, ever since we started it, was always to provide support.
Was this an undergrad program, graduate program?
Okay. Most of them are undergraduates, but we have master's students. They range from 18 years old until, you know, we have mature students in their 30s.
And how 40s. Big? How yes. big was the cohort?
130.
Oh, huge.
Yes, it's 130 students from all around the world together for 2.5 weeks working on something very intense. I've been working with multicultural teams for more than 10 years. And we also know from research that multicultural teams, they don't just happen. I think this is something we had already discussed in previous episodes. It's not because you put people from all around the world together that they emerge magically.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of information about the challenges that they are going to encounter. So we can already plan these 2.5 weeks with different checkpoints and interventions to really help those teams merge.
Right.
Usually the beginning is quite nice because everybody's super motivated, working in a diverse team. Everybody talks so much about diversity these days. You know, diversity is such a buzzword.
Oh, tell me about it, yes.
Right? Mm. So everybody who come in is very open to the idea of diversity.
Yeah.
So the first few days is really the honeymoon stage. Like, yes, let's go eat together and do this together and that together. And we love each other and all of that. But very quickly, they have to make decisions. They have to start working. And suddenly, you know, the the deep level differences. It's like not just the surface difference of you're Cambodian and then you are Singaporean and then you are Dutch, right? But the deep level differences in how we approach problems, how we express our ideas, how we communicate, how we structure work and things like that, they very quickly start to emerge. And that poses a big problem because most of these students, they have never worked in an international environment.
Right.
I mean, maybe there's some level of international diversity in their university, but because they all study in the same place, there are still some very strong norms on how to do work together, right?
Yeah. I wanted to ask how much of the group were actually from Cambodia itself, given that they're the hosts?
We had 20 plus teams. Every team had at least one member from Cambodia.
Right.
This was necessary because if we want students to think of a solution to a problem that is typically local, then they need
of
to
course.
Have access. There was language barrier.
Of
there
course.
Was a lot of challenges that were difficult to tackle if you didn't have someone from the culture.
Right, right. Yes. So can you give us an example? Like, what do you mean by when some of these patterns start to emerge? Yeah,
I have several examples, but one in particular. We usually tell the student in advance, like when they come to class, here is a problem you are going to encounter.
Right.
So I tell them one challenge you're going to have is communication and decisions. How do you communicate your ideas?
Yeah.
Who make decisions? And that day, a Cambodian student in the group, she raised her hand and she said, in my culture, there is always a leader. So when we work in a group, very quickly one person becomes the leader. Typically, is the one who is the older or the more mature or the more senior. Students, they usually use the year they are in or the age.
I see.
And that person is going to allocate work, is going to tell us what to do and make the decisions. But she said, in this team that I'm working with now, you know, because I have students from the UK, from Netherlands, from Australia, from all these different places, there's no leader.
Right.
Everybody can participate. Everybody can make decisions.
Mm.
And she said, this is very different from what I am used to.
Mm.
Now, I've seen the same patterns in my students in Singapore, which is typical of culture that are more hierarchical.
Yep.
So where power distance is higher, when usually they have higher level of collectivism. So people are more reluctant to disagree within the team. You know, they will have less conflicts and disagreement. And so the way they overcome that is by having someone appointed as the leader. So they don't have to fight to know who is right or wrong. They always turn towards the leader to make the final decision.
Right.
Yeah, so that's a typical example of a tension. And for the student from Cambodia, from Singapore, the Dutch, the you know the Western cultures, they found them very dominant.
Mm-hmm.
They are more willing to disagree more openly.
Yeah,
you know? It's like
yeah.
more debate, more discussions, and it can be a bit overwhelming for this student from Asia because of just because they are used to a very different way of communication, but. That is only one side of the problem. From the students from the Netherlands, the UK, Australia, they also look at the Asian counterpart and they think, wow, these guys, they don't speak very much.
Right, right.
They are very quiet all the time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do they want to work, right?
Yeah.
Like when you know nothing, you tend to assume you use your own cultural background to judge. You say, well, are they really motivated? Do they have anything to say, right? So that's where me and my colleague, we play an important role. Because we know these are the common problem, decisions and communication, we can tell them, already explain to them that it's not because they don't want to participate. It's because they communicate differently.
Yeah, and probably in their minds, you know, they need permission before they can speak, right?
Exactly. So typically in Asian high power distance, hierarchical, collectivistic culture, the way people work in groups, and I think we've spoken about that many times already, is a more structured way. So people will not just start saying things randomly. There is an order. There is a structure in the way people communicate, when they speak up, what they say. And generally, it starts with appointing a leader and then expecting that leader to invite everybody to say their piece, right?
Yeah.
And until... you know, until you have been invited, people will not naturally jump in and open up.
Yeah.
The other thing is there are norms of communication in Asia, not in every culture in Asia, but in some, that you only open your mouth if you have something to say that is very valuable for the group, right? Yeah. So there's also a lot of self-censoring going on in people.
That's true,
right? We see a lot less with culture that are more assertive, more open, where participation is more important than being correct or perfect, right? And so this is another area that is in this multicultural teams is quite challenging for the students to be proactive in speaking up, because first of all, the others, you know, from Europe, they usually take up all the speaking time. Nobody is filling in, right? Yeah. So they just speak. And then because in this culture, they are less of a self-censorship, people will start saying things without having thought it through very much, right?
Yeah.
And then they will talk for a long time to structure and formulate their thought and articulate them. And sometimes they will realize that, oh, well, actually, no, this is leading nowhere.
Right.
So it's a very different type of dynamic, and that creates some misunderstanding, tension, and frustration, especially among students like those who have never, ever experienced such large differences. Yeah.
I'm wondering, Catherine, among the Cambodian participants, did you manage to get any perspectives on how they picked the leader in that very diverse group that they're in? Because you're saying, like, typically in Cambodian culture, they'll look at people based on age or ranking or something. But in such a diverse group, like, you have people from different cultures, and I'm assuming you don't necessarily know how old everybody is or what their station in life is. Was there anything they shared on who they identified as the leader?
So I cannot say for every group, but generally they didn't. They didn't, because in the end it's the norms of decisions that was prevalent in Europe that prevailed. So because students from Europe, they come from more egalitarian culture, they don't feel comfortable appointing anybody, either because they don't want to or because too many people want to be leaders and don't want to fight over it. So it's easier, you know, for the peace of the group to agree that, okay, we can all be part of decisions. And so this group, they tend to shift towards a more consensus-based type of decisions.
Democratic.
Yeah, so then they will use different methods. They will vote. They will try to integrate everybody's ideas.
Right.
Now, the students from Europe, they tend to be more assertive and therefore more dominant. But at the same time, interdependence is very high. It means they cannot do the work without involving the other students. They need the Cambodian students because they have access to the local market. They can help translate. They can have access to important information. Typically, the students from Singapore, because Singapore is the... In Asia, it's the doorway to Asia.
It's the in-between.
Yes, it's the in-between. So even though they still follow very Asian mode of communication, because they speak English, their first language, so they don't have the additional hurdle of having to communicate in English, which is something that even for the students from Europe, unless they come from the UK, the Dutch have that issue also.
Right.
Students come and they are not all
articulate.
Very articulate in English. So the Singaporeans have that element where they understand the challenges of the Cambodian from a cultural standpoint, but at the same time, they can use their more articulate language skills to bridge the gap. So they are usually the peacekeepers.
The diplomats.
Yeah, they are the diplomats.
So,
that's right.
So the reason I asked about how the locals might have perceived who could be the potential leader is I'm just relating it back to my own experience, because being Filipino and, you know, having lived in Singapore for so long, I'd like to think I also straddle this diplomatic role.
That's right. Of,
you know, obviously I'm Asian and I definitely have a stronger connection to Asian cultures, but at the same time, because of my language skills and also partly because of Filipino culture, which is very heavily influenced by Spanish and American culture, I'm able to bridge this gap between East and West. And I totally related to what you said about Cambodians, like, I need a leader. I need somebody who will tell us what to do, give us the structure, etc. And over the years, especially after having worked in so many Western-led organizations, this has become less and less. Now I speak up more, I step up more. As Sheryl Sandberg would say, lean in more, all that. But I have observed in myself and in other Asians around me. So for example, right, let's say there's a meeting and it's this one of these scenarios where nobody really is an appointed leader, especially in these initial meetings, we're all like figuring things out, what are we going to do, blah, blah, blah. And then I come away from it feeling like, I'm not sure what to do next. And then you know what happens? I would privately message the person who I think is in charge and just say, hey, so what do you want me to do? What do you want us to do? Like, by when? And I'm sure I'm not the only one who does that. In that large group setting, obviously, I'm trying to conform, you know, instead of asking right there and then, who's leading this? Can I speak up? Blah, blah, blah. Of course, I'm conforming. Maybe I contributed to the conversation or not. Probably most of the time, I'm quiet because I'm figuring things out. And then everybody disperses. There's no clear leader. So then I'll just end up, yeah, messaging who looks the most leader-like, you know? So that's why I was asking, how did they evaluate who's the leader? Yeah.
You know, I find myself in projects and in groups over the past few years, and I had the same reaction as you. I am so used to the way things are done here in Singapore, where everything is so structured, so well organized, there's always an appointed leader and somebody in charge of making sure that everybody does everything that they're supposed to do. Now, when I am in those teams, when there's no appointed leader, it's a bit unsettling. It feels like a bit stressful even, right? But one thing that really surprised me every time when I work with people in Europe is even without clear and structured guidelines, people will take the initiative.
Yeah.
They will fill in the blank. And they will not worry so much about, should I do this? Should I not do
that's
it?
Right.
You know, will I make a mistake? Will anything happen to me, right?
Yeah. So, so that sounded like a really, really good intensive program, like what you said. And the way you engineered it, it really gave students the opportunity to work with all these different cultures.
Yes.
I wondered if we can now pivot to your own personal impressions and takeaways about Cambodian culture itself and what you learned when you met your colleagues in that country.
I really liked it. I only say Phnom Penh, which is a capital city, so it's wealthier than the rest of the country. Cambodia is a country that for the past 30 years has been built with a lot of international aid, which means that many international organizations have been in Cambodia for a long time, and usually they come to Phnom Penh because it's a capital city. So the city is easy to navigate, it's very safe. Most people speak English.
Right.
Much more than I thought it would. I didn't realize the extent to which English was widely spoken.
Right.
When I arrived in Phnom Penh, it reminded me of Beijing when I arrived in 2005, okay, almost 20 years ago. I think Beijing at the time was already economically more advanced.
Yep.
But it still had that vibe. You still had those old streets.
Yeah. Right? The hutongs.
Yeah, we would go to one neighborhood and then 1 month later, the whole thing would have disappeared. Yes. So it was that time in the development where the economic growth was so fast.
Spiking,
those things will change and lots of investment. And this is happening in Phnom Penh right now.
Okay.
When you look at the city, you can see it's very low rise, small houses, even in the city center. But you also see tall buildings, skyscrapers popping up here and there. There's a lot of Chinese investments.
Yeah.
So I like the vibe. It's like the vibe of a fast developing economy.
Yeah.
People are hopeful. The country seems to be on a good trajectory.
Yeah.
They see opportunities. The Ministry of Education is very involved in creating opportunities for people to go overseas. We have a lot of Cambodian students going to Singapore for study.
And
so you can really see that country opening up. But at the same time, it is still a very poor country.
Yeah.
We had entrepreneurs coming to talk to us about different projects and that they're doing, and they highlighted the fact that there is a huge proportion of children who are undernourished or stunted in their development because of poor access to certain
nutrition,
food.
Healthcare.
And there are lots of gaps, right?
Yeah.
Another thing, so in the history of Cambodia experienced a dictatorship in the 1970s under Pol Pot regime. And then that followed a genocide.
Yep.
Cambodian killing Cambodians.
Yeah, this was the Khmer Rouge.
That's right.
Yeah.
And one thing that shocked me is the level of openness that people have to talk about that history.
Yeah.
So you can visit the camps, like they call them the killing fields.
The killing fields, yeah.
The prisons.
The S21.
That's right. But it's not just about visiting those sites. But then when we talk to people, they will start talking about it.
Hmm.
I was at a dinner and there was another lady from the university who was sitting next to me and we were chit-chatting about our life and suddenly she tells me, oh yeah, you know, my grandmother, she always tells us, you're so spoiled. When we were under Pol Pot regime,
yes.
Life was so difficult.
Yeah.
So people are very free to talk about it. I had dinner one night with two of my former students,
yeah.
And their wife. And these are people who are younger than me, okay? Like they are in their early to mid-30s.
Yeah.
They were born in the late 80s.
Yeah,
grew up
yeah.
in the 90s. And so they asked me my impression. And I told them, you know, I feel like it's very amazing how open people are. And they
yeah.
say, yeah, we need to talk about those things because we don't want this to happen ever again.
Oh, that is actually good. Yeah.
Yeah. So then I asked them, how was it for you growing up, right?
Yeah.
Because even though the genocide happened in the 1970s, during the 1980s, there was war with Vietnam and then Cambodia was completely locked from the world because it was part of the communist bloc.
Yep.
And then in the 1990s, there was a civil war in Cambodia and the civil war only ended in 1998.
Mm.
So I asked them, I said, how was it growing up? And it was so interesting because the three of them had very different experience. So one of them said, oh, for me, I grew up near the border with Thailand, which is in the north of Cambodia, and life was okay.
Yeah.
Because along the border with Thailand, that's where all the NGOs could come. So people who lived across the border, they will have access to
okay.
better food, better education,
oh, okay.
you know, better healthcare. Then one of them said, for me, I grew up in a small town, maybe 1 hour from Phnom Penh. In that region, they were still fighting.
Yeah,
I remember my father was a government official. He would go to work during
yeah.
the day. And then at night, he would take his weapon
oh.
and join the group
wow.
to patrol the village
wow.
you know, to keep us safe.
Yeah.
And then the last one said, I grew up in the south. And the south is where the poorest towns were. And she said, over there, we know we lacked everything. And my younger brother died because we didn't have access to healthcare.
Right, right.
Medical treatment
yeah.
and all of this. And to me, what shocked me is these are people who are younger than me.
Yeah.
And
so very recent, all these
yes,
experiences.
Yes,
yeah,
and now they have good jobs and
yeah.
their life quality has improved a lot. And
in less than one generation, in their lifetimes,
it's
right?
Like 20 years.
Like
it's
rapid, yeah,
right?
rapid improvement.
That's
yeah.
right. And they can raise their children in a safe place and
yeah.
they don't have to worry and they can speak English and
yeah.
they can go study abroad.
Yeah.
But they had come and studied in Singapore and as part of their program, they could go to other countries and all of this. But they were also saying that, we cannot always join all the activities because it's too expensive. Because they come on scholarship.
Right.
The salary in Cambodia
of course,
very
yeah.
low compared to the classmates.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
you can really see the difference in
yeah.
lifestyle. So they say we can always go to all the activities with our classmates because they go to a bar, have a drink. It's not like they don't have the money. It's like, do I want to spend $20 on a drink?
Yes, I know,
you know
right?
Bar?
Yeah, okay. When that's my 1 month rent.
That also made me reflect on the fact that because I'm a foreigner and I only speak English, I don't speak Khmer. And so I only have access to the people who I can communicate with,
sure.
who represent already a certain level
of education. Right.
Even the students we had in our program, they all speak English because we were mostly working with the international college
yeah.
Branch of that university,
yeah.
which is a small program. They told us maybe it's 100 students
right.
compared to several thousands who will take
the local
exam in the local language, right? I remember one day we were walking out after work and then I hear a student behind us call us by her name. So I turn around and I see her and she's driving this huge SUV. And this is a 20-year-old student from our program. So you can imagine, you know, these are students who speak English fluently, who can go to those international colleges. So they probably come from wealthy family,
right.
Either people who work in the government or
yeah.
big multinational companies.
Right.
Maybe they are people who return from overseas or they have
yeah.
connections overseas because lots of Cambodians left
Correct.
The country and,
yeah.
and they are...
During the war.
That's
like,
right.
Yeah.
right. Mm. So that also got me thinking. We talk about this cultural element, right? Culture in multicultural teams, international collaborations and things like that. But for example, I work with Cambodian people. I cannot say that the Cambodian people I work with, they are also representative of the whole country or the whole culture.
You can or cannot. You can't.
You cannot. Because even within the country, you have variations. I get to work with the top of the pyramid, right?
Yes.
You know, the wealthier, yeah. more educated ones.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to bring this up because research showed that actually when it comes to understanding culture and specifically work values, we have to go beyond the cultural level.
Beyond the nationality.
That's right. Yeah. And that even within countries, there are huge variations, especially in countries where there is a huge gap between the rich and the poor.
Yeah.
Economic opportunities, correct. Education, wealth, economic freedom, you know, like your access to opportunities.
Yes.
Really affect the way you perceive work and your relationship with others.
No, absolutely. I hear what you're saying around we cannot generalize along national lines.
Yes.
For me personally, right? They find out I'm Filipino and there's certainly some assumptions straight away. I can't tell you how many times I've been complimented on my English. Like, oh, but you don't sound Filipino. Oh, your English is so good and blah, blah, blah. But I'm also bringing this up because recently I had facilitated a class. We mentioned before, you and I met for a nonprofit called IDA, which is a school for migrant domestic helpers, foreign domestic helpers here in Singapore. So the last class that I facilitated was made up of students from Myanmar, from Indonesia, from Philippines, and I posted about it on LinkedIn. So I was just trying to promote both volunteerism and cultural intelligence, wherein, you know, if you want to develop a skill, do volunteer work because practice is what makes perfect. So I just said that through volunteering with IDA, I develop more my cultural intelligence, specifically my communication skills, adjusting my language, being mindful of examples that I share about. And then it got me thinking, I wonder if anybody will comment on the fact that my students, I think half of them were from the Philippines. What kind of cultural adjustments do I still need to do? I mean, I'm Filipino. Why would I find the need to adjust my communication skills to my countrymen, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's exactly that, Catherine. It's the economic gap between myself and my students. To your point, right, when you come from these countries where there is a wide income gap, absolutely. Lifestyles definitely would be different. Your cultural perspectives would definitely be different because obviously if you're on the higher part of the pyramid, so to speak, you're exposed to more opportunities, travel, culture, arts, history, like education, reading, and this will definitely influence you versus people who have less economic opportunities. So I find myself whenever I'm facilitating a class, even if the class is made up of entirely a Filipino class, I'm always mindful of what kind of examples I would share about my life. I'm an avid scuba diver, so obviously if there's a challenge in scuba diving that I face that I want to relate to them, they can't. They won't be able to, right? So I would rather talk about more general things that I know I share in common with them, you know. Things like, oh my God, it's so hard to lose weight. That's like a universal problem. Or issues with friendship. Or issues with stress. So these kinds of stories that, you know, your audience can relate to. That's why I totally understand and can relate to what you shared about the national categorization of culture. It's not necessarily something you can generalize.
It's helpful if you don't know anything, but we have to remember that culture is always multi-layered.
Yes.
So once you know about the broad culture, you also have to ask, what's the background of these people? What's their level of education? Because it's not just about the examples, it's also about the advice we give people. Like, you do leadership training in your organization as
right,
well, right?
Right.
And our model of management and leadership that we adopt mostly from the West, that is predominant on social media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the advice you read about, you know, you have to
be assertive. Step up, yeah.
That's this mode of management, self-management, leadership. They come from a cultural background that is more egalitarian, low power distance, more risk taker, more individualistic, right? Like, you make your own choices, it's only about you. But the reality is, especially working with people who are lower social economic status, who come from countries where the development is not at the same level, some of this advice, they don't make any sense.
Absolutely.
Because in these countries or these cultures, at that level in the hierarchy, when you make a decision, you know, the day you decide to quit your job because you're not happy on your job anymore,
yeah,
it's not just about you.
Yeah.
It's about your family, your community, all the people who depend yeah. on you economically.
Yeah.
And when we tell people you have to stand up for your rights and all of this, yes, you do. But when you do that, you also take a big risk. You
yeah.
take a risk of challenging the status quo.
Yeah.
Now, if you are highly educated, if you have options to find work elsewhere, this yeah. is a much easier thing to do
yeah.
than when you already have debts that you're still trying to repay and you don't know that if your next job is going to be any better than the one
yeah.
that you have or,
yeah.
or it could really be worse,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. When you're in survival mode,
that's right.
It's tougher to make choice.
And so as leaders, as managers, as trainers, it's really important that when we are in a diverse audience, we understand not just the culture as a national culture, but also the culture that comes from
their socioeconomic status. Yeah. No, absolutely. But you just reminded me as well, about a month ago or 2 months ago, I was facilitating
yes.
Another leadership session at my company. And it was a diverse group. So we had obviously Singaporeans, we had Filipinos, we had Indians, we had Indonesians. I think we had one Westerner. However, I didn't find myself censoring myself as much when I was talking about, let's say, real life experiences. We were talking about leadership styles and what kind of manager they would like to be. And when we would be sharing stories about ourselves, yeah, I just didn't find the need to censor myself, despite all of us coming from a very, very diverse nationality background. I thought more or less we had more in common because we came from the same maybe corporate culture. Mm-hmm. The fact that we were all there in the room kind of signifies we've had good education, opportunities. So yeah, I find it very interesting that in that setting, I didn't feel the need as much to censor myself when it came yeah. to cultural communication.
And that's because diversity is multidimensional. There is a surface level diversity, which is a diversity that is visible, right? You know, you have male, female,
yeah.
you have people of different age, you have people of different nationality. But it's not because you look different that you actually are different. And that's a deep level diversity, the diversity of thoughts, right? Now, when you have a very strong corporate culture, there is less of a diversity of thought because you can default to the company culture, to the way that you have learned to think and approach yeah. problems within that organizational context. That's the same reason why when you talk to people who have the same economics background, you say you love diving. Well, you can find people from other cultures who love
Correct.
Diving. You have shared experiences.
Yep. Yep.
And this shared experience come not because you are from the same nationality, but they come from the fact that economically you have the means
yes.
to access this kind of experience, right?
Yep.
You love to travel. So we tend to see culture as something that takes us apart. But sometimes it's also something that can bring us together. And not every difference is going to be a deal breaker or cause tension and division. It really depends. And that's why I like this idea of cultural intelligence. Cultural intelligence is more about your ability to notice those nuances. So you're more agile, you're more flexible. You can teach a class on Sunday with migrant workers and tell them about your issues of losing weight because that's how you can relate to them. And then on Monday, you can give a leadership training in your multinational organization, you know, and talk about that
yeah.
experience because you know that some of them will relate to that,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So that's your cultural intelligence, your ability to look at
Thank
your audience.
Thank you.
Yeah. Notice. Notice where they come from and based on their background to adapt the way you communicate and relate with them.
Thank you for noticing my high cultural
yes.
intelligence. But just to circle back, right, to
yes,
what you
yes.
said, we often see culture as something that separates us when it's actually a means for us to connect and bridge with others. If I go back to that leadership session that I facilitated for my company, while I say that, yes, I have a lot in common with the people in that room based on our corporate background, there were still cultural gaps.
Ah.
Because some people were from the sales team. Some people were from IT. I am coming from a marketing background, maybe a bit on the creative design-y part of things. So when I would also try to cite, let's say, project experiences, I tend to be very vague because honestly, I really have no clue around the operations, technical, more really like heavy technicals, SLA, whatever, the frick jargony projects that they're going to be on, right? I guess my point in bringing that up is, aside from the differences in national culture, there are also differences in the culture of what type of role or team or profession you're in, right? Even within a company, there are these different cultural groups that exist.
That's right, yeah. Yes. What you describe is a deep level diversity, the diversity of thoughts that come from your occupation or your professional background, right? If you're an engineer, if you are in IT, you have very different considerations than if you are creative or in marketing or if you are in sales. And so sometimes these differences in the way we think can actually have deeper implication in the way we work with each other than maybe our national culture. That's why even within a culture, even in an organization where the culture is very strong, you will still have many subcultures that possibly will have different interests, different priorities, and you have to reconcile all of this.
Actually, I've started really verbalizing this. Every time I'm given a chance to present, I've started openly mentioning, you know, there's a cultural gap in our organization, right?
Wow.
I've said that on calls with like 30 people. I've had a couple of chats with upper level, managing director levels. You know, I think one of the core issues is the cultural difference between this team and that team, because, you know, everybody complains about everybody else, right?
Yes.
So I just want to start opening the eyes of the people around me, like, you guys know this is not just a personality. This person is dominating, or these people are giving us deadlines that are just unreasonable and then canceling at the last minute. I've now started giving this message like, guys, you know, there's a cultural gap between this big pillar of our organization versus our side of the organization. It's really two different cultures and we're supposed to be one company. So, you know, I don't have an answer for it, obviously. I'm just starting to plant the seeds of just be aware.
Yeah.
The people on that floor have a different culture to the people on our floor.
Yeah. I think this is a great thing that you're doing, because if we don't see culture, we tend to blame it on the people. And generally, I am right and you are wrong, right? But from their point of view, they are right and you are wrong. It's a power struggle.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
And when we start seeing this as it's just different cultures that operate for different reasons. Like if you are a marketing department, you want to be a little bit more loose in your culture, open to new ideas, because that's where creativity comes from. But if you're the accounting department, you don't want your accounting department to be too loose.
That's right.
So once we understand why those differences exist, then we can be more open to discuss and compromise.
Yeah, we need those people to be like that.
Yeah, actually, tight and loose culture is a cultural concept. I don't think we've spoken about this ever, but people who study this, they say that in reality, the best way is not to be either or, is to be both. But
correct.
The challenge is, how do you live with these contradictions within your organization?
Right? Yeah, and that's something we will dive deeper on in future episodes. Just to wrap it up, so through Catherine's experiences in Cambodia, we talked about national culture. It's just like your first basic general broad view of culture, but even within nationalities, socioeconomics also have a huge influence on how you view culture. Another layer of culture is the roles that we play in our organizations, depending on the team we're working with, on the job that we're supposed to do. So surface level diversity, the ones that probably you can easily assume and see, like, you know, race, nationality, and the deep level wherein you have diversity of thought, which takes a little more effort to unpack, to parse, and probably also takes more time to observe and tease out. Cool. This is our last episode of season two. It's been another amazing journey. But Catherine, tell us, what can we expect in season three?
So season three, we'll be sharing more of our thoughts and reflections on cultural intelligence, application of CQ in real life from our travels and experiences. We will also have interviews with experts, so a professor specialized in intercultural negotiations, very likely, and very seasoned senior leaders in the industry who work with cultural diversity.
So, right, yes, like people who have been senior leaders in large multinational organizations, yes, and have like long experience dealing with super diverse cultures for a long time. Before we formally close off, I heard we are supposed to have a bonus episode.
Yeah.
Tell me about this bonus episode.
We are going to let you listen to the very first episode of The Cultural Quotient. In fact, this episode was recorded before our podcast ever existed. So this will be an interview of another seasoned manager with experience in different countries in Asia, and you will get lots of tips and ideas of how to use cultural intelligence to manage teams from the perspective of someone who has done it.
And who is this special person?
And he's my husband.
Oh, there you go.
Well, I had to try it with someone, so I picked the person who was the easiest to talk to. Turns out that he's pretty good at what he does.
You did this at home, or?
Yeah. So that was interview from our living room.
Hey, come on. There are all these companies that started in their garage, in their basement. You know? And this one started in Catherine's living room. So you will hear the true origin story of the CQ podcast in the bonus episode,
the first episode for
season two, featuring Andy Wu. All right. Thank you, Catherine, for all the great conversations we had this season. And to all of you out there, thank you so much for listening. Please continue to share, continue to like, and we look forward to hearing from you in season three. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you for listening.
Remember to give us 5 stars or leave a comment, question, or feedback on LinkedIn.
Till next time.